Noticias: las críticas de Washington a la selección china de personas que presentan al mundo la antorcha olímpica se ha transformado en una lección de derechos humanos para la Unión Americana. Beatriz Salas amplía la información.
Decidir sobre quiénes serán los portadores de la antorcha en la ceremonia inaugural de los Juegos Olímpicos de invierno en Pekín es la responsabilidad de China, y Estados Unidos no está en posición de hacer comentarios despectivos. Así respondió Pekín a la reciente interferencia de Washington, quien aseveró que la elección de China de la atleta de la etnia Uyghur, Denijir Jilamujian, para llevar la antorcha olímpica es un esfuerzo de Pekín para distraer la atención del llamado genocidio en la región de Xinjiang.
Los llamados comentarios de genocidio de Estados Unidos son la gran mentira del siglo y exponen su intento de politizar los Juegos Olímpicos de Invierno y su siniestra intención de utilizar el tema relacionado con Xinjiang para difamar a China.
China asimismo acusó a Estados Unidos de mentir de manera descarada sobre las minorías étnicas, mientras olvida sistemáticamente discriminaciones en su propio suelo.
Estados Unidos llevó a cabo un genocidio contra los nativos americanos en el pasado y ha discriminado sistemáticamente a las minorías raciales a largo plazo. La población de nativos americanos se ha desplomado de 5 millones a finales del siglo XV a unos 250 mil a principios del siglo XX, reduciéndose a una vigésima parte. ¿Qué es el genocidio? Las políticas que Estados Unidos ha impuesto a los nativos americanos son un verdadero genocidio.
Zhao, además de criticar la discriminación racial contra los africanos y asiáticos en Estados Unidos, dijo que elegir a un atleta de la etnia Uyghur muestra que la política de China de promover los deportes de invierno y mejorar la salud de las personas está beneficiando a individuos de todos los grupos étnicos y prueba que no existe discriminación.
Lo que Estados Unidos debería estar haciendo es revisar cuidadosamente sus propios crímenes históricos contra los nativos americanos y tomar medidas concretas para reducir la discriminación racial contra estas personas y otras minorías raciales, como los africanos y asiáticos.
China, en reiteradas ocasiones, ha instado a Estados Unidos a dejar de usar los asuntos vinculados con Xinjiang para difundir mentiras, interferir en los asuntos internos de China o intentar detener el desarrollo del país. Advierte que, de lo contrario, Pekín dará una respuesta más contundente a la luz del desarrollo de la situación. Beatriz Salas, con información de Niloufar Shakuri, Hispan TV Noticias.
Migrantes de todos los rincones del mundo duermen bajo su mismo cielo estrellado. Me los encuentro en las calles, en los cines, en los supermercados, y el olor de sus comidas me embriaga de placer. Todos ellos son mis vecinos.
Y yo aquí vivo, bajo sus leyes domésticas, pago impuestos y mis manos producen la riqueza nacional.
Soy parte de esa comunidad que vive, trabaja y sueña con una mañana mejor para nuestras familias.
Casi todos migrantes como yo, casi todos soñadores como yo.
Trabajemos pues en la construcción de otra nación que nos haga dignos.
Seamos los arquitectos de nuestro sueño colectivo.
Esta radio no tiene comerciales porque tú nos apoyas. Si ya has hecho una aportación económica, te damos las gracias. Si no, hazlo ahora en kpfk.org o llama al 818-985-5735.
Así llegamos al final de esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro más profundo agradecimiento a todos los medios y personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
They told me, you know, we'll give you a day, we'll give you a week, however long it takes for you to accept our help to be healed and to become a child of God and denounce being gay.
Honoring the memory of Dr. Anonymous, coming up on the Rainbow Minute.
got three quarters of the way through several times and was like, well, I have no idea how this would end, so I have to start over. But one thing I know is I can't end a story without hope.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Nicaragua's NGO Purge targets its oldest queer group. Gay Taiwanese movie sings out a universal love song and upending the artistic process with Amanda Kayback. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Joe Bainline.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 28, 2021. The government of Nicaragua is aiming to shut down the country's oldest LGBTQ advocacy group. The Interior Ministry has asked the National Assembly to annul the legal nonprofit status of Fundación Xiquetzal and 14 other non-governmental organizations. President.
Well, today is August 18th. A little bit of trouble getting together to do this netcast. I'm not sure why, but we had a tumultuous Huff meeting today, pretty well attended. We had Joy Schindeldecker who came. She's a mayoral candidate. We had at least four or five folks unhoused, two or three of them from the Benchlands, and folks from Food Not Bombs. Former veterans of Food Not Bombs, the housed person or three. But in any case, you're about to hear I'm not even sure what you're about to hear. There's a long interview that I'm going to be playing at least part of with Darius Marizan, whose name I can never properly pronounce his last name. I'll just call him Darius. He's a landlord who actually owns property that's a kitty corner from where Huff meets. And I challenged him at one point to clarify the costs of a landlord compared to the profits in some detail on a particular property. And he promised me he'd do that, but never actually did. And so I kind of blew him off. And indeed, a number of Huffsters feel pretty strongly about not even wanting Darius in the area because they feel he's some kind of a spy or whatever. Anyway, you're going to hear some of that in this interview I do with him. I don't know if I'm going to do it all because a lot of it has to do with real estate details, which frankly I could not follow in really a persuasive way that I could really understand and persuade myself that I understood them well enough to be able to make a decision. But I'm playing it because I think it... He does talk about his own properties. He does talk about the issue of rent versus expenses for a landlord, which people can then judge. If you're listening to it and you disagree, please do give me a call on the Huff line at 831-423-4833. He also was, you'll hear this more as we get on. I'd say more to the point, but it's not clear that we're really getting anywhere in terms of getting more information yet about the situation with the Benchlands removal. That is, at least the fencing of the upper duck pond area is well underway. And there's been blockage of food at the food deliveries by Food Not Bombs, at least on one occasion. Blockage perhaps isn't the word. The person who gave the food, a woman named Joy, different Joy than the mayoral candidate, was given a 300 and $30 ticket or however much it is for going into the benchlands with a vehicle to deliver the food, which is something Food Not Bombs reportedly has done regularly. We had one of the activists, Laura Chatham, has done that when she was with Food Not Bombs. She testified that's what she did. Or at least she testified that she was a regular provider of food to the benchlands. Not sure if she actually got in there with a vehicle, but that's something that there was only one occasion, according to Keith McHenry, who's done that repeatedly, where he was stopped by police. That's what he said when we talked to him about it. There is a city council meeting coming up next Tuesday, which supposedly will have a quarterly report on the homelessness removal that is being planned, or they like to put it as relocation, except they don't tell you where they're going to relocate the hundreds of people who are in the benchlands. Sort of in a sunny, reassuring way, they tell you it's all being taken care of, and we'll give you more information at the next meeting. So, anyway, let's begin and see where we get to.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you. Sing me of wars and sing me of breadlines. Tell me of front page news. Sing me of strikes and last minute headlines. Dress your observation in syncopation. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must get hot with what is what, or I won't love you. I want a song that's satirical, putting the mere into miracle. Must be packed with social fact, or I won't love you. Sing me of kings and conferences martial. Tell me of mills and mines. Sing me of courts that aren't impartial. What's to be done with them? Tell me in rhythm. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do.
So that, of course, was our theme song, or has been for years now. Hopefully we'll find a little something different to play. But it's Sing Me a Song of Social Significance from Pins and Needles, the musical. I played the full rendition of that one at the request of a loyal listener. And, well, that's why it was inflicted, or actually maybe an opportunity to enjoy it, too. Darius is we're going to begin with, the landlord. He is also frequently shows up at different meetings of homeless activism. So, for instance, he showed up at the second meeting of the Union of the Homeless and Food Not Bombs, trying to generate concerns and give homeless folks a voice who are being faced with deportation from the benchlands to who knows where. And that happened, that's happened so far 2 Mondays at the Resource Center for Nonviolence, and it's due to happen again next Monday, which would be the 22nd. You're invited if you're interested in this, if you want to be supportive. Darius didn't get a chance to speak at this meeting because I suspect it was because the leadership there was not interested in really hearing him, or didn't trust him, or felt they had other... The main purpose of the meeting was to have Benchlands residents talk. And there were some others who were allowed to speak, such as Brent Adams, a service provider who was usually no fan of protest activism around homeless issues in Santa Cruz. There hasn't been for some time, although he sometimes speaks out himself quite candidly, and I think with telling effect, on what he knows about how the city is, should we say, making the wrong choices in trying to provide alternatives for even the small number of alternatives that it does provide. Anyway, we're going to hear a bit of Darius, and if you have any comments or thoughts, please call in. You'll not be able to reach me when you hear the show, but I will pay attention to any messages you have. And if you want to debate or discuss issues in more detail or challenge certain things that are said and want to be heard yourself online on this show, do leave a message and I'll get back to you with that, in case you can't really have enough time in the answering machine to actually say everything you want to. So let's jump into it now and hopefully enjoy getting our feet wet. Okay, well, today is the 17th of August. It's about 2:15. I'm on the line with Darius Merzarin. I can never get your name right, Darius. How do I pronounce it?
Mosinine. It looks worse than it sounds.
Mosinine. Well, it's... Yeah, I guess if you're born with it, you can deal with it. Why not?
It's Persian.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You speak any foreign languages?
I wish I did. I was actually born there. That makes me a person of color, right?
Well, I think that makes you a dirty traitor to everything that's American.
Anyway, I lived there 6 months, and my dad got his degrees in this country. Wanted to go back to Iran, teach agricultural engineering, kind of like young Jews go back to Israel, you know, to rebuild the country or build the country.
Have you been back yourself?
I did. I was there when I was 15 years old, because if I were 16, they would have drafted me. Can you believe that? And
what year was that?
1975. All I remember is listening to Goodbye Yellow Brick Road when we traveled.
Oh, so that was before the
Europe to Iran. Drove there.
That was before the Iranian before the revolution.
Exactly. Shah was very much in power.
Well, Darius, getting back to the reason, I know you've called in order to express your concerns about what happened or what you wanted to say, but had no opportunity to say, or at least I guess none that I heard in a public way at this meeting that we had at the Resource Center for Nonviolence regarding the Benchlands crisis that's coming up. And indeed, they're fencing off the park even as we speak, as you probably know. At least not the Benchlands, but the upper part of the park, the duck pond. Before I get into that, though, I have to... I really want to get to an issue that you made a commitment on, but you never came through on.
I was going to talk to you about that, too. That's the other reason.
Why don't we start with that? Because if I can get that out of the way, then I don't have to say I'm letting Darius lead me around by the nose and not do what he says he's supposed to do, because I want to get that out of the way. So at one Huff meeting, we were bringing up issues of what kind of expenses do landlords have, and, you know, what do they pay in taxes, mortgage, expenditures for problems, and also what are the extent of their holdings? Now, you boldly, or it seemed at the time, bravely volunteered, and before some of the audience, I would say, was critical, if not hostile, and some was sympathetic, perhaps, or at least neutral, to talk about your own holdings. And you... never did. And you said you would do it later, and you never did. This was years ago, 2 years ago at least, I think. And I want to hear what you have to say, but I want to kind of set this up so people know what I was asking, at least what I expected from you. And I mean, you know, you've been accused of being a slumlord. You're a very I don't want to say notorious political public figure, because that's said of me, and I don't like to regard myself as
a wear that badge of honor.
Well, I mean, it's a way of dismissing someone and not looking at the arguments or the claims that they're making. And I know you regard yourself as a serious observer, a serious participant, and someone who believes that he has something meaningful to say about a number of subjects. That's been my general impression of you. I don't agree with you. There are some people who don't want to even let you in the room because they feel you have betrayed people at Ross Camp and elsewhere. But, you know, that...
Or I'm just a troll.
You are an information source for police or for other politicians who are hostile to us. And, you know, I'm an information source for that kind of stuff, too, in the sense that I put out stuff for everyone. And I do attend meetings where I'm not welcome as well, occasionally, perhaps less so, you know, as they get on. But the one thing you did say you were going to do was at least take one of your properties where you are renting to people who are low income and maybe some people who are not so low income, and talk about the rents you get compared to the expenses you pay, because this was a major issue in the rent control controversy, as I see it. It even was an issue 2 years ago when Justin Cummings got this weak bill passed that said that voluntarily landlords can clarify what their, you know, what their rental situation is. I don't think much of that was done. But
I don't think there was such a thing passed. That was like the rental registry.
Something like that. It was a summer 2020 bill done, even though there was a, you know, that the year before Drew Glover and Chris Crone had been recalled, and you had a right wing or a council that was at least hostile to rent control or, you know, any kind of controls on landlords. So anyway,
I think that was a rental registry he was advocating.
Which, that could be it. Yeah.
Again, I frankly don't speak for my peers. In fact, I'm probably a lone wolf, but I don't have a problem with that. I mean, I think folks like myself and realtors would gain more from such a registry than activists.
Well, let's take one of your.
But I don't think, you know, you'll never. Everything is couched in, of privacy, and they're trying to
We don't even need to go down that rabbit hole, because I think you and I agree. But the issue, let's take one of your properties, like 1010 Pacific, or not 1010 Pacific.
Well, let me just take a little mile high view and explain kind of like why it's not as easy as just answering your question. First of all, the answer, there's two ways to look at landlords. Income, expenses, at the end of the day, what you want to know is how profitable is being a landlord in Santa Cruz, okay? And that's fine. Now, you can go, the income, expenses, rent, and so forth, that stuff is pretty much public information, not for individuals, but if you go to, like, LoopNet, which is a popular commercial real estate, think Zillow for income properties, commercial properties, okay? And just go search any multi-residential property that's in Santa Cruz, and they put the income expenses that's part of the sales package. It's all there. The only difference is taxes. For instance, they will, when they're selling a property, obviously it gets reassessed at the sales price. So, you know, a property that I bought in 1986 for $140,000, a triplex on Locust Street, my tax rate, my property tax is criminally low. I don't want to say criminally, but it's unfairly low, $3,000, okay, after all the Prop 13 raises. That property, when sold, it's basically $1.3 million property. The new property tax would be $13,000, 1%, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So
But let me interrupt you just a moment here, because this would mean, it would seem to me, that if you wanted to give me a simple answer to the question I did ask you 2 years ago, and you committed yourself to answering 2 years ago, it wouldn't have been very hard for you to, instead of saying, go see, well, what's the website you talked about? Loop?
Yeah, LoopNet.
How do you spell it?
Loop, L-O-O-P, net, N-E-T.
Gotcha. And it would have been really easy for you to say, okay, I mean, you can say go to LoopNet, or you can just say, here are the figures for you, Robert, for one piece of property. That would have kept your commitment. That's the commitment I'm asking you to keep now. So are we going to be doing that, or are we going to be talking about things generally?
Oh, anything you want. I think you're going to be a little surprised by...
Well, I hope so. I mean, I don't mind being surprised. I'd love to be favorably surprised and learn that the landlords are, a fair and honest bunch, and that accusations made of people against people, I don't know about like yourself, but you specifically may not be justified. I mean, it's important to clear up what the facts are in these situations. So the real issue is not so much how much profit you make, although that becomes a part of it, but whether the amount of rent you are charging is unreasonable compared to the costs for you. In other words, more important, of course, are the rent raises over the years as well. So take a piece of property and walk me through it.
Okay, I'm going to do two things, but we'll start with what you asked. I'm going to go and bring up my Google Drive with my latest spreadsheet on all the properties.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll read you all the figures. But let me tell you, I'm probably unique in, amongst my peers, but I'm quite, be honest with you, I'm conflicted being a landlord. And let me tell you why. What other investment? Real estate is a unique investment in that provides three benefits. One, OPM, other people's money. You're using the bank's money. You're leveraging a small down payment, 25% typically, and you're using the bank's money. So your investment is 25% of, let's call it $1 million property, that'll buy you $5 today. You put down $250,000, the bank carries it, and then so if the property appreciates to $1.5 million, that's 50% appreciation. But look what it is on your 250. It's like 300%, right? You see, and that's the advantage of leverage. And in a consistently increasing market like the coastal markets of the coastal areas of the country, you're always going to have appreciation. Everybody's going to want to live in Santa Cruz. Everybody's going to want to live in Santa Barbara. Everybody's going to want to live in L.A. There'll be no shortage of. And there's not a lot of land to build on. So anyway, it's a very safe, T-bill. It's like a T-bill. It's extremely safe. Not to say people have been foreclosed on, but that's not because of the underlying dynamics of real estate. It's because they got over leveraged. But that's a whole other topic. Okay, so other people's money. Two, tax leverage. Tax base. We get these, let's face it, our legislators that write the laws, the tax laws, they're real estate people. They stack the deck. I mean, Trump 2017 tax cuts, it benefited me. I'm not a Trump fan, trust me, but he just threw out more benefits to real estate for people in this country. And it happens all the time. Real estate, again, lobbyists, our elected representatives, particularly at the federal level that make tax laws, they favor the real estate people. So let's get that out of the way.
Well, I assume that's also true with Democrats in power as well.
I just said, I didn't say party. I said elected officials of all.
Right, but you mentioned Trump, so I assume that you...
No, I mentioned Trump. I don't want to say... I said Trump's tax, if you want to call it reform, of 2017, or Tax Act, it benefited folks like me. But I do want to...
Right, and what I wanted to clarify was, and you're apparently verifying that, is that it's also true under Obama and Biden. But is that accurate?
Biden, well, again, we're going to get in the weeds, but Biden is trying to nip away at something that's very favorable, one of the most significant drivers of commercial real estate, and that is something called a 1031 exchange. 1031 is that part of the IRS tax code that allows you to defer capital gains when you trade one property, so it's called trading, for a higher value property. So, I mean, let me get here. I just did this. I bought my triplex for $140,000 in 1986. Okay? The tenants, and this is the other part, this is where I'm conflicted, it's the tenants that were the flywheel effect, if you will. They were the ones that kept my investment not only alive and from being foreclosed on by the bank because I didn't make the payments on it, but they're there not, it's their money that then goes, keeps the property alive year after year, appreciating year after year, giving me a tax benefit, passive through depreciation year after year. And by the way, they're putting some shekels in my pocket in the form of profit. That's an amazing investment. That's what real estate is. Then I sold that property in 2019 for $1.2 million. And it was free and clear, by the way. I paid the mortgage long ago for $140. So I have $1.2 million, which under normal capital gains, if you sold stock, et cetera, or anything else, you're going to pay long-term capital gains, which at the end of the day, after federal, state, something called investment tax, and so forth, it's about 35 to 40%. So $300,000 to $400,000 would go to the government. But no, us real estate folks, the deck is rigged. It's rigged. It's stacked. We get to buy another piece of commercial real estate, higher value, defer all that gain. Don't pay us a penny of tax on it. We defer that gain. That's how real estate wealth is built this time.
Now, by defer, do you mean eliminate it or have to pay it in a few years?
Defer. No, defer it until you sell the other building. Okay? So I buy a building in Las Vegas. I bought a strip mall. That money is, so the gain's captured now in the strip mall. The IRS, there's forms you fill out that keep track of your gain and all the depreciation you've taken, which you have to give back. That's another thing. Again, this is getting the complicated tax code. Okay? And then you haven't paid a dime of taxes on that $300,000, that million dollar gain. All right? Because it's embedded in the new property, so to speak. It was traded, you know, deferred to the new property. Then you keep doing that. But guess what happens? Okay? I die. Right? Well, there's something called a step up. And that's when the government gives this incredible gift to real estate people, again, whereby your heirs, then when I die, that property gets what's called a step-up in basis, and basis is what the taxable basis is the taxable value is for establishing capital gains. So that one point, so let's say I die and the Las Vegas property, for instance, is now worth $4 million. Okay? $4 million. And remember, I started from $140,000. And now, the amount of tax owed, again, 30 to 40% on $4 million, if it were sold, would be, do the math, $1 to $1.5 million. Well, guess what? The government says, oh, we're so sorry your dad died. We're going to let you, we're going to step up the basis to the current appraised value of $4 million. And you can sell it tomorrow and you won't pay a dime of tax. My joke. I mean, again, this is the tax code. Why is it this way? Because it favors real estate investors. And that's how this built in real estate. Trump, Helmsley, Sam Zell, all the big shots, you know, they do it by just trading up constantly.
And, you know, that actually is very interesting, Darius. I'm just, and I mean that sincerely, I'm very ignorant on issues of these kinds of loopholes, or I should say advantages, that real estate investors have. But it's time to break this narrative up with a little music. So that's what we're going to do. Thank you. The name of that song was Henry Lee, and it's from Peggy Seeger's 2004 album, Heading for Home. I'm trying to find more notes on it. She's got her own website, peggyseeger.com, but it's got a lot of other albums, but nothing on that album, so darn. Anyway, back to Darius M. So the point, I mean, that's while that's very interesting, again, I want to focus on your one piece of property that you're working on that you have and look at the rents you charge compared to the expenses, including taxes, that you have to pay out.
Mm-hmm. Let me bring one up. Okay. So let's take that 690 Pacific right across from your Huff meeting, right?
All right.
I'm trying to find my spreadsheets. But the bottom line is, hold on, let me...
Now, remember, I'm not insisting that you be accurate to the penny or the dollar. If you have a ballpark sense of this, that's all that I need.
Okay. All right. 690 Pacific. Okay, so...
And how big is this property? Let's get some idea what this is about.
18 units, 10,500 square feet.
And
oh,
how,
no, 7,500.
How many people does it normally house?
Well, it's 18 units, and I tend to rent 16 of 18, by the way, are Section 8. So, again, I'm not your conventional landlord in Santa Cruz because I do majority Section 8.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, anyway, and that's right now, I mean, I think, you know, how many do you tend a one-bedroom apartment house? I mean, I tend to have one person per bedroom or per unit. So, I mean, and I have a family in a two-bedroom, and so I think there might be a total of 20-odd folks here, you know, because most are one person except for her.
Mm-hmm. And how long has this group of people, has a group been there, the majority of them, let's say?
They're very long-term. They're very long-term. For one thing, two reasons. A, for Section 8. Very difficult to move. There's not a lot of mobility, and when you find a good place with a decent landlord, which they tend to think I am, they stay put. Okay, and it's a great location. You're 3 blocks from the wharf, for crying out loud, right? So, anyway, now, in fact, that building was acquired in 1998 for $1,065,000. Okay, so that it was just appraised for $4.9 million. Okay.
Okay. Does that mean, Darius, that if you wanted, you could essentially reap, I don't know, a $2.5 million profit? If you
that refinance?
I'm not. You know, I. Again, you're dealing with someone who's untutored in this kind of stuff.
I think I know what you're going to. So it was purchased for $1 million in 1998.
That was by you purchased it, or?
In this case, my family.
Okay.
This one, there's two groups here. We've got my own grassroots I bought with my money, which is one set of buildings, and then there's the family. This is what my parents bought.
Mm-hmm.
And I have five siblings. My parents died in 2018. And what I did is I refinanced and bought them out. Okay? So I took on an enormous amount of debt and paid them out. Okay? Plus some of my own money. But that's a whole other story.
So, right. But if this operation were still run by either your family or, you know, your parents or your family, and they had still owned it and they chose to sell it, they would reap a $2.5 million profit. Is that accurate?
Well, 3.8, but anyway, yeah.
3.8, okay, right. So much for my math.
Yeah, you got $1,000,065 was purchased in 1998. Appraised at $5 million. It sells at $5 million. So there's a $4 million profit. That minus, $3.5 million minus transaction.
In any case, right, so that's a substantial profit. Now, again, the question is, you would also, of course, be getting the profit of over the years through the period of time which your family owned it or you owned it, whatever kind of rental you got on it. That would be what you essentially – I assume there's also other considerations like how much the bank would allow you to leverage it for and so forth. But just looking at the straight rental compared to the expenses, what's the story on that piece of property?
All right. So gross income is for gross income of 2020. It's maybe $380,000. Okay.
So per year.
Yep.
So we're taking one. Let's take a one-year period. $380,000 is the gross income. And what would you say the expenses are? And during that year.
Okay. Well, property tax again. It's laughably low, $16,000 because of Prop 13.
Okay. Repairs and upkeep.
Insurance is $5,900. Utilities were $19,000. And other expenses, repairs, upkeep, and so forth, I put as $15,000.
So under $100,000.
Well under. Not well under. 20, 35, 45, about $60,000. Yep.
Okay, so yeah, you're right. It is significantly under $100,000.
Mm-hmm.
So, again... the amount of gross income was 300 and some thousand, did you say?
Yeah. We call that, in real estate, we call that NOI, net operating income. Okay?
Okay. Now, is it fair to say then that at least in some sense, gross profit is subtracting the costs from the income?
Gross profit is subtracting everything but debt service, everything but the mortgage from the income.
Right. So the
NOI.
But the mortgage, has to do with
a lot of parameters.
Borrowing money from the bank, I guess, to
right.
do it.
So the reason they use this NOI figure is because it's the true operating income, income expenditures for that piece of property.
Now, if you were to add your mortgage costs, how much would that bite into the essential, what is it? We're talking about what's the difference between the NOI and the costs?
Okay. See, so this is why, so this is where things go differently. It depends on how much money, you know. So in the typical real estate, banks will let you leverage 75%, okay? So they only require 25% down for most properties. So they're covering 75% at I just refinanced this very building at a quite a favorable rate of 3.2%. Okay? So my mortgage now is $11,000 a month.
So in a typical year, you would be you'd be paying about $130,000 or $140,000 to the bank.
Exactly.
So if you had bought it all with your own money, this would all be sheer gravy for you.
If I paid cash, $4.9 million, whatever, cash, and my operating and my income is $380,000, and my operating expenses are $60,000. Yeah, that's $320,000 in into my pocket.
Well, let me ask you then, and although you may have no way of knowing this, do you have a sense of what percentage of the landlords in Santa Cruz can afford to directly pay cash?
Depends. It's foolish to do that because you're tying up all your capital, and at the end of the day, I mean, at today's prices, for instance, you hear this narrative about investors buying up homes in Santa Cruz to rent. There's no way a savvy investor would invest in single-family homes in Santa Cruz and rent them because they would be making less return on their investment than a CD, well, than a passbook savings account, to be honest with you. I'll give you an example. I mean, let's take a $2 million house on the west side, okay? Call it a four-bedroom. I don't know, right? The most it can rent for is $6,000 a month, all right? So $6,000 a month is three, what is that?
$72,000 a year.
$72,000 a year. But they pay $2 million, so their property tax is $20,000, $21,000. So that 60, that 72 goes down to 62, 60 pretty quickly. Insurance is going to be $1,500. Right. So let's, you know, make repairs. They might have property management. A lot of times they have property management, which is 6% of rent. But at the end of the day, let's say they end up with $50,000 after a $2 million investment. What's $50,000 on a $2 million investment? It's hideous. $50,000 divided by $2 million. I'll do this out loud.
I think it's 0.5% or something.
0.5%. That is ridiculous. Again, no savvy investor would typically does that. Now, if they use, okay, go to the bank. They put down 25% or 20, you know, on the property, and then again, their return will be better because the bank's doing the heavy lifting. Okay. Because remember, their return's going to be on not $2 million, but on 25% of $2 million, which is $500,000. However, that $50,000 NOI, remember? Oh no, it's going to go down to 20 because it has the debt service on $1.5 million, right? So now they might end up with $20,000, actually probably less, $10,000 on a $250,000 investment. It's still, it's no big windfall at all. I mean, 4%. So now, question you should be asking, well, but, Harriet, they have these, this is Santa Cruz, that appreciate. Well, true. So there are folks that are, and there are people that will do it. They will go buy a house for cash, or they'll buy a house with a mortgage for the purpose of renting it. They'll suck up the 2 to 4% low return, but they know 5 years, that's going to be worth 20% more because that's how it, I mean, I've been tracking, I bought my first place in 1986. I've been tracking prices since then, and it's, you know, I tell people there's no such thing as an overpriced home in Santa Cruz because it always will increase. It always will.
What do you estimate are the number of investors who engage in, a real estate flipping here in Santa Cruz?
Flipping's hard because I flip, okay? I've got enough tenants and toilets. I don't want more.
Explain what flipping is, of course, before we go.
Okay, so flipping is you buy an undervalued house that needs value-added, that's the term we use. Value-added, which is a cute word for, you know, maybe a dump or something needs work. Okay? So, it's all about buying at the right price. So, I mean, I've looked at value-added properties in Capitola and Santa Cruz, and there's not a lot. There's not a lot of folks that let these million-dollar assets go to crap. I mean, there are. You can see them. Some are actually empty. That's empty homes, actually. If you want to get to that, we can talk about that, too. However, it's very difficult to find flip candidates here in Santa Cruz because, A, every realtor is chasing them, okay? There's always that person that will pay pretty good premium, okay? Because they want to live in a house. They're in terms of flipper gets the flipper values and the upside profit, fixing it up, buying, fixing, and selling, and whatever's left over is your profit. However, for somebody that wants to get into a house in Santa Cruz for less money than, quote, retail, and they're willing to put in sweat equity, or fix it up, they're not looking at whatever the value is on the flip. They're looking at the intrinsic value they get from being able to live in the house. So that is what pushes up even value added properties.
Well, I guess
they have more value because people buy them because they live in them, and their economics are different because it's their home.
Well, what I'm asking you though is, let's say if you look over the last year, do you see a lot of house flipping going on in Santa Cruz?
I've seen some because I was outbid on some, so I know certain homes. And some they make anywhere. I've seen as little as $50,000 profit. I've seen as much as maybe $150,000, $200,000. Okay, and I don't know. To some people, that might be a lot of money. In the real estate world, it's good. $50,000 is a lot of work and trips to Home Depot and dealing with contractors for $50,000. But hey. Now, I did a flip, and I've done two flips, one in Folsom. Okay? There's online auction site. I bought properties, sometimes site unseen. And I paid $440 for a really nice home in a really nice neighborhood in Folsom, California, that didn't need a lot of work to get in. I had to crawl through a window. There's no key, no nothing, after I bought it. And I rehabbed it, new floor. I replaced the carpeting with hardwood engineered floors, paint, cabinets, and I sold it for $530. And at the end of the day, after all my expenses, I made about $60,000.
And we'll be resuming this analysis probably on Sunday. I think it's really important. I think that there needs to be a real understanding of, if there is such a thing as average profit made, if you consider expenses for a building over a period of time compared to the rents that are paid. And we do actually get into talking about that towards the end of the interview. So if you found this of interest and you're of a mathematical frame of mind, or if you want to comment on it, and before I go any further, please, again, do call me at 831-423-HUFF, 423-HUFF, 423-4833, or shoot me an email at rnorse, R-N-O-R-S-E 3, number 3, at hotmail.com. Let's take a musical break.
And that was Girl of Constant Sorrow, one of the best-known songs, according to the liner notes, from the film O Brother, Where Art Thou? At least one of the best-known songs from that movie is Man of Constant Sorrow, a high, lonesome love song. The words of the industrial version recorded here, Peggy Seeger writes, are by Sarah Ogan Gunning, who chronicled the lives of the southern mining communities of the United States during the 1930s and 1940s. And again, this is from the album Heading for Home. And here's a story from the San Francisco Chronicle of August 17th. San Francisco police use of cameras at BLM protests, that's Black Lives Matter, challenged by Bob Agelko. He's the kind of the legal writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. Privacy rights advocates told a state appeals court Monday that San Francisco police illegally used a network of private surveillance cameras to track demonstrators during 8 days of Black Lives Matter protests in 2020. A 2019 ordinance requires police or any other city agency to obtain approval from the Board of Supervisors before using surveillance technology. Gee, wouldn't that be nice if we had such a similar provision here? Perhaps we do, and I don't know about it, but I haven't heard that we do. But the ordinance allows an agency, quote, possessing or using surveillance equipment to keep using it while supervisors are considering their policy, and that exemption is the focus of the court case in San Francisco. The suit challenged the police department's alleged use of more than 300 cameras provided by the private Union Square Business Improvement District. I always hear the warning bells when the improvement district comes up. Any improvement district. It's usually a way of running out poor people in the area, particularly homeless people. To monitor local demonstrators in late May and early June 2020 during nationwide protests over the killing of George Floyd by Minneapolis police. Defending the surveillance, the city said the Business Improvement District had allowed police to use its camera network to follow participants at a Pride Day march in 2019. City lawyers argued, and Superior Court Judge Richard Ulmer agreed this February, that police had been possessing or using the cameras at the 2019 event and were thus entitled to keep using them at the protests in 2020. The ruling misinterpreted the ordinance and allowed police to invade individual privacy without asking permission from elected officials, as the local law requires, attorneys from the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the American Civil Liberties Union said in a filing Monday with the First District Court of Appeals. The law's exception for an agency possessing or using surveillance equipment refers to current ongoing possession or use, not deployment of cameras for a single day in the past, the lawyers said. Allowing a one-time use to justify future surveillance, they said, quote, undermines the ordinance's overall purpose to ensure democratic control over surveillance technology. By requiring police to seek supervisors' approval to use surveillance cameras, the privacy advocate said, the ordinance was intended to allow residents to comment on and debate the use of potentially intrusive technology. The SFPD has a long and well-documented history of spying on marginalized groups and political movements, the court filing said. It cited a 1975 report that said the police department had collected files on more than 100,000 civil rights demonstrators, union members, and anti-war activists. In addition to the Black Lives Matter demonstrations, the advocate said the Business Improvement District allowed police to use its cameras to surveil participants in a 2020 4th of July street celebration and on a planned Super Bowl parade in February 2020, an event that was canceled when 49ers lost to the New Orleans Saints. In response, Jen Quart, spokesperson for the city attorney David Chu, said, we agree with the trial court's decision that evaluated these issues based on the facts and the plain language of the city's ordinance. The suit was filed by three organizers of the 2020 protests. They did not allege that they or anyone else had been arrested or harassed because of the camera surveillance, but said Learning about it afterwards discouraged them and others from taking part in future demonstrations. And that's, again, Chronicle, August 17, 2022. San Francisco police use of cameras at BLM protests challenged by Bob Agelko. And what I would say, and perhaps remind old-time listeners about, is that I have repeatedly sought to get information on the presence of cameras that are used for surveillance by police in public places, downtown and elsewhere. And the police claim there are no such cameras, which, of course, belies belief, not because I'm a fan of immediately jumping to the conclusion that police are having great fun doing the peeping Tom thing, or the peeping, I don't know, call it the peeping, I can't think of the right word. But there are cameras around. There are cameras at the police station. There are cameras around City Hall. And the idea that they won't disclose the location of those cameras is just, to me, it's a form of arrogant denial of the rights of the public to know in public spots, assuming that they're not investigating a particular criminal activity and they're setting up some special hidden cameras for that purpose. It's a violation of your right to be free from that kind of invasion of your privacy. You say, well, you go in public and you have a right, you know, you have to expect that you can, for example, anybody can film you. They can, but it's not your tax dollars that's paying for it and your police department that's compiling records around it. You're paying for that. You know, you shouldn't have to pay for surveillance on yourself. That's how I feel, even though the theory behind that is it may help in the solving of some crime. It may also help in suppressing different kinds of protests, which is exactly the wrong thing, particularly these days. And here is an old story which probably needs to be repeated, although it's going to be kind of old hat many to many listeners. This is California Should Legalize Drugs, It Works Elsewhere, by Joe Rosenheim. Who grew up in San Francisco, he writes, an opiate addict for 11 years, has been in recovery for 6 years, and is director of InScape Recovery, an addiction treatment center near Mexico City. And this is from the Mercury News of August 17th. Why not legalize drugs? All drugs. It's not a new idea, but amid the unending debate over how existing laws should be enforced, It merits renewed consideration in California and beyond. If drugs were legalized, overdoses and property crimes would plummet. The black market for drugs would largely dry up. Emergency services would be freed up. Police officers could be repurposed. And jails and courtrooms wouldn't be stuffed with low-level offenders. Meanwhile, users stabilized on legal drugs could get off the street hustle hamster wheel that consumes their time. Absent this underground lifestyle, many would get bored and either quit using outright or go to rehab. Not incidentally, the number of homeless would decline. Even so, those who continue using would do so in a regulated environment that obviates the need to obtain money criminally and frees time to pursue more constructive ends. As for illegal drug sellers, legalization would make many of them obsolete, not to mention the impact on international organized crime. Legalization, as opposed to decriminalization, doesn't just mean not arresting people for possession, but actually supplying the drugs through a legally regulated institution to people who are addicted. Drug legalization for addicts is not without precedent. In the United States, we practice a form of it by providing methadone and Suboxone. Although these opiate substitutes are often ineffective and can be even more difficult to kick than heroin, there are currently several countries, including Switzerland, Germany, the Netherlands, and Canada, that in varying degrees allow addicts to obtain prescription heroin. Where legal heroin is easily obtainable, statistics show not just a reduction in crime, but significant drops in addiction itself. In Switzerland, which made legalized heroin available in 1994, the The number of new heroin users declined 80% by 2010, according to the Stanford Review. Another study by the University of Lausanne in Switzerland found that among those who joined the program at its inception, there were reductions in property crimes and drug selling of over 50% within 6 months. Legalization does not appear to encourage drug addiction. If anything, it seems to discourage use overall by removing the enticement, as it is for some, of a freewheeling life outside the law and replacing it with boring old institutional support. I would legalize synthesized versions of heroin, cocaine, and amphetamines. These drugs are available widely anyway, already, both on the street and through the internet. Besides that, they have long had prescription legal pharmaceutical equivalents. Opioids such as fentanyl and OxyContin, Adderall, Ritalin, and Desoxin, prescription methamphetamines, among them. The narcotics could be provided cheap or free by clinics or pharmacies to people who are medically registered, just as with Suboxone and methadone. To get them, you would have to make a conscious decision to see a doctor or field worker, have an interview, sign paperwork, and enter the system as a drug-dependent person. The same system can then support addicts with services around employment, housing, rehab, and therapy, which will work better when addicts have the stability and time to exit street life. A 2008 study in Germany found that among participants who received legal heroin over 24 months, there was a 76% improvement in employment, 20% increase in stable housing, and an 84% drop in crime, according to the journal Addiction. Why, nobody's asking if people were happier, but that's another story, I guess. Why not at least start the conversation around legalized drugs here, or try a ballot measure? Consider that until a few decades ago, the legalization of marijuana was to many people unthinkable. Legalization is a solution long hidden in plain view among the litany of political contortions trying to make prohibition workable. Time to end the obsession with fighting drugs, along with the manifold consequences of their illegality, and turn more attention towards other problems. I can say that again. California should legalize drugs. It works elsewhere is the name of this. I guess it's kind of an editorial by Joe Rosenheim in yesterday's Mercury News. And I guess the only caveat I would have with that is it's the idea of putting people in dependent positions with respect to nonprofits, with respect to government, instead of simply decriminalizing drugs so people can use them as a matter of choice, and then also have these true drug rehabilitation facilities available for those who feel they want to be monitored. It still puts people in a position of a kind of subservience that I wonder about. I wonder about it when homeless people are given these nanny situations for housing that don't represent what, let's say, they don't really mirror the rights of citizenship that people who are housed have. So it's like saying they aren't as worthy, they aren't as capable, they aren't as competent. And it ignores the fact that our existing society, which is essentially puts a huge amount of money into war, huge amount of money into policing, a huge amount of money into enterprises that don't really provide human joy, and continue to retain and expand a kind of profiteering that has great differential between rich and poor. And it produces a lot of simple poverty all over the place and exploits foreign countries. Unless you start addressing this in a broader way, having people mind you in order to make it legal to use addictive drugs is, to me, is also a problem. And now it's time for another musical break. Here's a long version, at least it certainly seems like a long version, of Phil Oakes' song, The War Is Over, previously unreleased, according to this online claim. It looks like, though, it's part of an album, Phil Oakes, The Best of the Best, or sorry, The Best of the Rest. And it's it was released, I don't know about the album, but it was put up online in 2020.
Silent soldiers on a silver screen, framed in fantasies and drugged in dreams, unpaid actors of the mystery. The mad director knows that freedom will not make you free. What's this got to do with me? I declare the war is over. It's over. It's over. All the children play with Gatling guns. Tattooed mothers with their tattooed sons. The strong will wonder if they're surely strong. It doesn't matter lately whether we are right or wrong, but surely we've gone on too long. Cardboard cowboys in a new frontier, drowning Indians in vats of beer. Troops are leaving on the Trojan train. The sun is in their eyes, but I am hiding from the rain. Now one of us must be insane. I declare the war is over. It's over. It's over. Drums are drizzling on a grain of sand. Fading rhythms of a fading land. Prove your courage in the proud parade. Trust your leaders where mistakes are almost never made. And they're afraid that I'm afraid. I'm afraid the war is over. It's over. It's over. Angry artist painting angry signs. Use their vision just to blind the blind. Poison players of a grisly game. One is guilty and the other gets to point the blame. Pardon me if I refrain. The war is over. It's over.
working, building tanks and planes. And race is coming, so we can't complain. The master of the marsh has lost his mind. Perhaps some other war, this fabled farce would all be fine. But now we're running out of time. Why declare the war is over? It's over. It's over. So do your duty, boys, and join with pride. Serve your country in her suicide. Find a flag so you can wave goodbye. But just before the end, even treason might be worth a try. This country is too young to die. One-legged veterans will greet the dawn, and their whistling marches as they mow the lawn. And the gargoyles only sit and greet. The gypsy fortune teller told me that we've been deceived. You only are what you believe. And I believe the war is over. It's over. It's over. It's over.
Yeah. The song is over.
It's over.
And now back to the Santa Cruz town clock, where Food Not Bombs was throwing its daily meal, which it does every day, more or less noon to 3, although 1 o'clock is when the food usually shows up.
So we're talking with
Christy Lamone.
Christy, it's August 14th, and we're at the Food Not Bombs meal, and it's about 1:15.
Hi.
Hello, sir.
Indeed. Well, you can call me Majesty if you wish.
Okay, Your Majesty, sir.
Your Honor, Your Grace, Your Fear, whatever. So, Christy, what you say you had to leave the Benchlands?
Yes, my friend.
What happened?
Well,
if you wish to say.
I do. I want to start with this. Number one, there's a lot of broken hearts down there. Number two, one faucet for so many people. No water, they're already brokenhearted, us all. There's a lot of brutality, violence. But they're all brokenhearted. They've had to scramble and steal. They've never been taught anything better. And then if you take a brokenhearted, my friend, and you put them down there, and they have to wash themselves in mud, their only escape is drugs, alcohol.
How long were you there for?
Off and on for about 8 months.
And why did you stay as long as you did?
Because I met so many good people there.
And when did you leave?
The night before last.
And was that precipitated by an incident, or was it just over a period of time?
Because it started to change me down there, because I started to become angry because of the pain, the grief that all of them and us, my peers, feel. And then the degradation of the police were very mean.
Tell me about that.
Okay, so then I noticed this. There's a couple cats around there, my friend. And I'm going to speak freely. So Jeremy, he would pick and choose who got to stay.
Who would?
Yeah.
Jeremy Leonard.
Yeah. And then he would do weird, nefarious, like, sneaky back things like, dismiss you. if you're trying to talk to him. He cut the electrical cords. Now, remember, there's, I haven't taken count, but I figure there's a whole lot of people down in that small bench lands, okay? Way more than should be. So it doesn't even pass the fire code anymore. Right? So then the poverty, I want to say this, people, like everyone's so good, like what you're doing, Food Not Bombs, the homeless union, there's not enough people that feel strong enough to even have a word. Maybe as children they were hurt, maybe not taught any better. But I just know that the sorrow there breeds contempt.
Now, is Jeremy encouraging people to leave or pressuring people to leave the benchlands?
May I say something?
Of course.
Okay, so I was down there. Now, this is going to be long. Can I say something on a personal note? You can edit it out.
I can stop recording if you
like. No, you don't have to. Just whatever. I'm not lying. So last year I went to the Salvation Army up there. And because I'd never really been homeless, you know, I'd never really been to Santa Cruz before. But, you know, by the grace of free food, you know, and friends, it was okay. But a lot of thievery and a lot of brutality. By the grace of God, I wasn't raped because I just happened to know how to
hunt yourself.
Yeah. But I didn't never have attacked someone physically unless it was to protect. Got that? No. Oh, my God. There's so much more to say. So, in a concise answer, Jeremy, so I went up to the Salvation Army. I drink a bit. I'm a little buzzed right now. I'm a drinker.
And you're still coherent.
Yeah. So anyways, I go up to the armory, and I have to stay in the common room, and I sleep by the door. I wake up to this man I've never met grabbing my boob, a contusion like this, and I went into PTSD, anxiety, panic attack. I mean, fight and flight. The woman up there wouldn't even talk to me while the man ate oatmeal. So then I was apparently ostracized from there without knowing. I just said, I will never go back there again.
When was this?
This was last year, about August.
You only went there once, and that was that.
Yeah, yeah. So then I tried to get into the new Salvation Army area. So
the Overlook?
Yes, as I was called, yeah. So, because, you know, I heard it was gated, there's showers, you know, it's a calmer community. And so Jeremy didn't show up on the 27th of, I believe it was the 27th of
July?
I think so.
Today is, this is August now.
No, no, it's prior to that. It must have been in March. The days go by. Mm-hmm. So my point being this, he didn't show up, so when I seen him, I flagged him down. He's a, you know, very busy man. I'm not blaming this all on him. I'm saying that he needs to be more supportive to what his cause is.
Accessible?
Yeah, maybe. So he said, oh, no, you're not allowed to do your band. I said, why? He said, oh, because of an incident. So I go to HPHB. I talk to the lady there. She calls them up for me, you know, like the nurse lady. I don't know her name. Anyway, so she calls up and she says, well, yeah, there was that contusion thing, which I'd explain to Jeremy. But no, there's a prior one to that. Why wasn't I kicked out on the prior incident? What incident are they talking about? So, yeah, that wasn't fair. But I love all the people that go down there to help.
And so then instead you went to the benchlands?
No, I was staying there. And anyways, I just wanted to get out. And the police brutality is horrible.
Anything recent that's happened there?
My whole camp usurped. When you're not a promiscuous person, you may be brutalized and beat up, but think, you know, nothing worse. But yeah.
Pressure for a sexual activity?
Yes, absolutely, 100%. And under the guise of they'll steal everything, they'll send their goons out there to steal it all. Still, I think so. Then you're dependent on others.
Now, are these are people who live there, or people who just come in there?
Well, I see both types. Now, I will say this: I've seen a couple of things of people that were disgusted by us, my peers, the homeless, and well, the most brutal down there are the ones with the money.
With the
money.
Really? Well, they're better than you are. You know that.
Of course, because I don't steal bikes.
You're not as efficient as they are.
No, no, I'm not. I will say this. I love you, my friend. But I've got a whole lot more to say, and I don't know how to articulate it for tomorrow night at 6.
Well, come tomorrow and try.
I've got signatures from almost everyone down there.
There was a lot of people, as you know, who came.
Sorry.
That's okay.
But the brutality of the police was even worse. That caused so much anxiety. I've been arrested for things I was not guilty of.
Last thing you were arrested for, what?
Was drunk in public, which I was not. I begged for them to give me a test. But see, what happened was someone falsely called on me because I'm a drinker. Right? But I wasn't. It's first thing in the morning.
How long ago was it?
That must have been February.
You haven't been arrested since then?
Well, this is the worst one. No, I haven't. No. So anyway, so then I have big old cops. Now I have titanium rods and screws. I suffer PTSD, anxiety, depression, you know, all of it. Panic attack. And now social anxiety. So it takes by these cops, and they're brutalizing me. You could feel right there. So they, right here, I got titanium rods and screws. They are tearing me asunder.
I can hear something or feel something.
Yeah, yeah, so titanium rods and screws. And they're doing this because I wasn't even guilty. And they were on private property.
Now, did you get vindicated in court, or did you ever go to court?
No, I haven't gone because there's so much to do just to come and get food and survive, find a safe place to sleep.
And so since February, you have been a renegade at large. Could I get a bounty for turning you in?
Probably, but they won't even arrest me because I have so many warrants out of my home.
You're collecting warrants, sort of a new thing with you.
Well, if it's unjust and you plead out just to get out, well, yeah, it's a little unjust. But anyways, they dropped the drunken public charge, but they got me for resisting arrest.
You didn't resist successfully, and you were still captured.
They were hurting on my titanium rods and screws coming out, and I wasn't guilty. And I'm 5 foot tall, 120 pounds. My big RoboCop's up on top of me.
Where was this happening?
That was the sheriff's. It was right up here on the road. There's apartments next to the gym on the right, and I rented a room there. And
they came after you.
You don't even know. You don't even know.
No, I don't. You're telling me.
I wouldn't take up too much of your time, sir. I really don't. But that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Well, I'm glad you are, and we've been talking with
Christy Lynn Lamone.
Thank you, Christy.
Thank you, my friend. Your Majesty, sire, sir.
The Blessed One.
Your real name?
Mr. Robert.
Robert, I lost your information.
I'll give you a card in case you want
it. I lost your... I didn't lose it. They stole my wallet. Whoever they are, I just know they're not us. Okay? I don't know who they are.
I haven't got your wallet.
I don't think so.
Thank you, Christy.
I'm homeless and I won't steal your microphone.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. All right. Now, again, we're talking with the pink pipe woman.
Yeah, this is Cooper D'Angelo.
Cooper, what do you got for us today? And who is this questionable doggy that's nearby?
This is such a sweet doggy. This is Rhonda's little doggy named Star.
Hey, Star. Rhonda.
And then we have Justin's little doggy named Freedom. They're all signs, you know, messages.
What news do you have for us?
Well, it was really disheartening this morning, which today is Sunday, and many people seek shelter in their vehicles that stay in the parking lot of Front Street and like behind Keontae's and behind all those apartments that are above Pizza My Heart. And we've stayed there on some occasions and had no trouble. When we stay there in during the day, we pay for a whole day's stay there if we stay there. But this morning, very early, like before 7 a.m., we're woken up by the city worker doing the leaf blowing with the big leaf blower. And
were there leaves to be blown?
I don't know. She was doing the parking lot, and we sleep with the windows down, and some of the campers that camp next to us don't have a vehicle, and they're on the ground. And so...
Not anymore, they're not.
Dirt was coming in the car window. I got out of the car, and I went and said, people are sleeping. She took the leaf blower into her pile of dirt and blew it right at me, into my face, into my eyes. My friend Justin got it on his phone and recorded it. She told me to shut up, that she could do whatever she wanted. I said, people are sleeping. This is Sunday morning. This is like 7 a.m., and all those people at El Centro and all those apartments are right there, too. And she said, you're not supposed to be sleeping in your car with, I guess, so I don't know if she was doing it on purpose to harass the homeless people who are residents here that have to seek shelter in their car, you know, due to the corruption in Santa Cruz. And so anyway, I guess, so I think she called the police. She said, "You're harassing me." And I've got dirt in my face. I can hardly breathe because all that, I mean, she did it over and over, all this dirt.
You were on the ground when this happened?
No. I'm standing there trying to speak to her, and very unprofessional. And this is a city worker who's using a city tool as a weapon, and used it and blew all that stuff all over me. And you know, I believe that people have the right until 8 a.m. to have some kind of peaceful sleep. And I'm talking about the people in those apartments. It's Sunday morning. Their windows are open. It's hot up there. And they have to be woken up by a city employee that's out there and then going to attack a resident. And so she's on the phone calling the cops, and I said, "Please do. I want to file assault charges." And the cop talked to her, and I guess she had to leave. And that was good, because she would have come close to my friends and blown all that dirt right on top of them. And that's
assault. How many people were directly affected on the in the cars or on the ground?
Like six people or more?
About six, yep. And we had one female who is over 65 years old. She was kicked out of the armory for the night. They kicked her out of the armory with no blankets, no pillow, no coat. She came to us and we helped her out. And she was also on the ground there. And then she was able to go back to the armory today. But what kind of immoral city-run crap is that they would kick a woman at 65 years old to go sleep on cement with no blankets? And I want to know what the credentials are of this person making those decisions, that is able to kick a senior citizen out to the street. Because, you know, they're making money on her Social Security number up there. They're making money on her. She's at the armory. Yep, they get paid.
They get paid even if they kicked her out that night.
How do you know this?
Because they all get paid for the head that comes there. Regardless, they're there that night or not, they still get paid because their signature is there for that space. So they get paid for that.
Okay.
And so that was really bad, but that's a city employee, and it has a direct reflection on the conduct of the city. When you have the lowest employees really terrorizing the residents, I don't know if she lives here. So why are these people coming in our town and harassing the residents?
Well, they're paid to do that.
They're paid to do it. And that's where money is the root of all evil, is because there are certain...
The county and the city management needs to get together with the people out here, the people in the homes and people on the street, and quit listening to all that garbage at the town hall meeting that never discusses the things that need to be discussed. Instead, they shove it underneath or close the session and arrest people because they call them on their shot.
Are you going to be coming? Is anybody here coming to this meeting tomorrow?
There's going to be a lot of us coming to the meeting.
Right on.
I had one once before. I love it. It's like stealing a badge from him.
I got one of those ones.
Do you need a hat like this?
I'll make it.
Harass people in their motorhome saying that
it's not a
highway county property.
Mama.
I went shopping for you after you left.
It's federal property.
It's cute.
Out here.
Highway 1 is a state highway.
Are you a witness to any of this stuff?
Yeah, there. I was one of the guys keeping on the floor, on the ground.
What is your name, sir?
I'm Robert Yates.
And Robert, tell me your account of what happened.
Well, I was woken up by the leaf blower and Cooper yelling. Wanted to know why she's being woke up at 6:30 in the morning. And actually, we all kind of were wondering that.
How close was the leaf blower to you?
Probably the other side of the parking lot. So one lane's parked to one side, other side right there.
And how many folks do you estimate were there?
Like Russ was saying, about 5 to 6.
Uh-huh.
5 to 6 of us.
Is this a frequent place where folks sleep that you've seen? Or?
Yeah, actually, there's a lot of people that frequent that parking lot.
And this isn't one of those city Association of Faith communities or Salvation Army run programs, is it?
Not at all, no.
It's just a place where people go park.
A safe place they found on their own, yeah.
And are there, is this going to deter you from going back tonight?
Absolutely. We have to find a different place to be. Because if we stay, we've already been painted a target by the police. Both those officers were looking at us and taking pictures of our face, and they had a body cam on, and I know we were being filmed. So they're taking numbers, and they're taking identification, and they're going to make a move soon. I know they are. They are. They're going to try and flush us out.
How long had you stayed there before this happened?
At most 4 days in a row. But we usually have to get vacate after about that because we get
a migrating scene.
They will be. Yes, they will be. And when that happens, it's going to be a really bad day. It is, because these guys don't have anywhere to go, and they're just going to spill out onto the streets, and everybody's going to freak out.
Now, the bench line, as I take it, is not an alternative for you?
Negative. No, I came here, and I was on my own for about 2 or 3 weeks. I met up with Cooper and Russ. I've known Russ for about 30 years, and I've been living around here for 30 years.
Indoors or outdoors?
Oh, indoors. I've only been homeless. This is the first time in my life. I've only been homeless for 3 months.
What prompted it, if you wish to say?
Well, actually, it was Biden's lifting of the eviction ban. And my realtor did not tell me, or my landlord didn't tell me that it was coming up. I had no idea it was going to be there. The next thing I know, it's the 3rd of June, and I got a 3-day pay or get out notice from the sheriff's department.
Probably an illegal notice.
I don't know. I think that they weaseled their way around the legalities. And besides, this is like, it's webbed all throughout our whole government. So, my best friend over here is probably thinking one way, and another one's over here is thinking the complete opposite. The divide is incredible, and it's no more so than here. I haven't been back to Santa Cruz in about 10 years, and when I got here, it was so corrupt. It was obvious.
Tell me a bit about the corruption.
Officers acting without impunity, not citing the correct codes, making stuff up as they go, planting evidence, disappearing people. I mean, you name it. It's all going on right here. And everybody knows not to call the police because they won't help you. They will probably do you in.
Will you be coming to this resource center, what to do about the benchlands meeting tomorrow?
Absolutely. I have an address here. I'm a citizen. I'm a local, man. I've been here living.
Well, as a local, you deserve a card.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, buddy.
I was supposed to say, this is your punishment for being a local.
All right. Thank you very much.
I'll play these interviews on Thursday night. It's not a radio, it's a netcast, but it'll be archived, so your friends can all hear you years from now. You can be embarrassed at that time.
Well, I appreciate what you're doing, and, we need to spread the word, because the people need to know.
I agree.
The people need to know, my friend. All right.
And we've been talking with?
Robert Yates.
Thank you, Robert. Robert Norris here.
Pleasure to meet you, sir.
Mucho gusto.
Okay,
nada. Rhonda, anything you want to...
Right here, this guy's looking for you.
Hey, Jerry. And now another brief musical break. This is another Phil Oakes tune that I haven't heard, if I've heard it at all, in quite a while. It's from the same album, The Best of the Rest, posted a couple years ago on YouTube. You can find it there. But here it is here, and it's called Take It Out of My Youth.
The young knight was thirsty as I entered the back of the bar. The smoke held the air as the floating tables were scarred. In back of the counter, the man asked, "What can I do?" And all I could say was, "One on the way, and take it out of my youth." The voice from the jukebox was singing much more than a song. The magic of music picked up my mind and was gone. Caressed by a corner, I sat in the shadows of blue. My glass quickly drained, I called out the name
and said, take it out of my youth. My eyes were drawn to the dancers forsaking their day. Swaying and swirling, they shook with the passions of play. In total abandon, the freedom of frenzy it grew. And just as before, I'll have one more and take it out of my youth. The women were wearing the paint that covered their frown, fluid and flowing and formed in the loose-fitting gown. Red lips were ruddy, revealing much less than they knew. So I said to my friend, let's do it again and take it out of my youth. And the sounds were obscene as the wine drop visions were blurred, as the hours escaped to dungeons of wet, empty words. My mind was swimming in a sea too familiar to fool. So I gave him the sign, just one more time, and take it out of my youth. Now a toast to tomorrow, as we dance on the fast rolling logs. And a toast to today, as frustration is drowned in the fog. Lost to the world, lost to each other, it's true. The signal was down, just one more round, and take it out of my youth. And the world disappeared as though shot with a warm whiskey gun. As proudly we played and frolicked in desperate fun. The cold night was laughing and waiting outside of the room. So here's where I'll stand and drink to the damned and take it out of my youth.
So next up, we're going to have a little snatchit of the last meeting. The Benchlands Resistance and Defense, I don't know if they'd call themselves that, but it was the Union of the Homeless and Funa Bombs. And I would say Huff showed up too. That was me and Gloria and a few others hiding in the bushes or in the wings at the Resource Center for Nonviolence on their second Monday meeting, which will be followed by a third Monday meeting next Monday on the 22nd, in case you want to come. I think I've already mentioned this. It starts at 6. If you want to come to the Food Not Bombs meeting, that starts at 5. So it's up to you if you want to try to get together to do something while the city prepares to essentially bulldoze section by section in order to beautify the Benchlands and the San Lorenzo Park by, of course, despoiling the current campground, wretched as it may be in many respects, and certainly underserved and under-resourced, no question about that. So, let's hear a little bit of it. Don't have too much time, but I may play more. And if you want to hear or see more, because you can actually see the speakers, some of them who came up to the mic, there were about 30 or 40 people in the room, sometimes 50, perhaps. And there was more than a dozen from the Benchlands, perhaps even more than two dozen. I'm not sure about a lot of homeless folks or folks are unhoused, but some of them didn't clarify where they were from. But people from the Benchlands were particularly invited up to the mic. So here's a little bit of that, and you can actually hear more directly if you go to Commander X, also known as, I call him Kerbucker Chris, but it's Chris Doyen, who was a Santa Cruz homeless activist back at Peace Camp 2010, and for a long time he was sort of an internet fighter with Anonymous, and these days he's doing a lot of educational podcasting to put folks in the know, and there this podcast is available online. If you go to Commander X's website, he has a YouTube channel which you can find by shooting me an email at rnorse3@hotmail.com. I'd read it to you, but it's full of letters and numbers. It might be a little hard to put forward and not terribly entertaining. You also can subscribe to, well, that's a kind of a advanced word for me. If you send me an email at the same address, you can become a part of my twice weekly, or actually sometimes four times weekly, email announcements of the Huff meetings, three times weekly, twice for the next show, once for the Huff meeting, which gives you an advanced copy of what's likely to be on the agenda and also what is on the show, the net show. Again, that's rnorse3@hotmail.com. Now let's go back to Monday the 15th, and Keith McHenry is introducing the Union of the Homeless reach out to people in the Benchlands to encourage them to sign up so they can be on board for an injunction, which he and Alicia Kuhl and others are putting together, presumably even without an attorney. Or so they say.
What we really want is for people that live on the bench lands or outside to come forward and tell a little bit about their, what will happen to them if they are removed from the bench lands. And so we are also going to be starting we're going to file a lawsuit in the next couple of days to block the eviction from the bench lands. So we're preparing that, and that will probably be filed in a couple of days, I would say, an injunction, a temporary restraining order to block the eviction until every single person in the bench land has adequate indoor shelter. Because under Martin versus Boise, you can't be put in a overlook camp. That's illegal. Doesn't meet the standard. There's only a total of 25 locations, according to the city attorney's office, for the several hundred people in the benchlands to move to. So what we'll do is, in a little bit, once people have gathered, we're still a little early, we will then do a live stream. If you don't want your face being seen by people around the world, let us know. Maybe what we'll do is just only get the audio of you. We'll turn the camera away from the person's face. If you are on parole or probation, or reason don't want people to see your face. So in that sense, we're hoping, last week we had about 20 people from the Benchland show up. It's pretty amazing. And we voted to have this meeting about this specific issue. So we also voted to invite the city politicians to come to hear what people in the Benchlands have to say about their condition. And the reason that vote happened was, and why we have everybody from the Benchlands vote to do this, is because people expressed their what problems they had with the alleged solution. So, for instance, one woman discussed how she went to Overlook, which used to be called Golf Links, which used to be called the camp next to the Armory, and the staff was so abusive that even though she's in a walker and disabled, she walked away from there and moved into the bushes down by the benchlands. And now that woman, because she's been terrorized by Jeremy Leonard, is moving to the Pogonville. So that, I'm not sure the people in Santa Cruz really want hundreds of people living in the footprint, but or the doorways downtown, but that's what's going to happen. Is about several hundred people are going to end up just living randomly around downtown or in the benchlands. If we do not have some success first in the temporary restraining order, and in using and forcing them by either refusing to leave or some other means to actually provide real adequate shelter space for people living outside. So that's our goal. So we're not really officially started at this one. It's not even 6 o'clock. And did you have something to say, Tom? They're going to clear the, starting to clear the bench lands on Wednesday, kind of is what they go, wink, wink, nod, nod. It's supposed to be cleared completely by the 1st of September. So you should be, you're going to get a lot of people moving here to this parking lot.
Yeah,
it's a vote for the city council.
What happened, you know, the problem here is because the insurance liability, we're a non-profit. So if someone is on the property and they cause a problem or hurt someone, we're liable for it. That's why we can't have anybody staying here.
And that's why this, the Resource Center for Nonviolence should be telling the city mayor and the city manager that this problem, because in reality, even the those places that have, that are commercial places with liability issues are going to be in trouble. Right? So it's the entire downtown. So there needs to be an actual, you know, and we've been talking about this since everybody moved to the benchlands, that there had to be an actual place for people to move to, because no, you know, because it's not really the greatest place for people to be living. And I think we will hear that from people that are going to speak this evening about the logistical problems that occur as a result of living at the benchlands and then being forced into the streets. Yeah.
So I just wonder if there's any, going to be any part of this presentation or discussion that's going to acknowledge that it sounds like an increased level of hostile presence of law enforcement in the bench life. I mean, I'm reading this business of suit up bombs, you know, getting a ticket, volunteering getting a ticket in a fairly hostile manner. It's not just would you please move. It's like, boom, you're getting a ticket kind of thing. And so, you know, and ways of strategies, is there going to be any time to spend on it? And offering strategies for dealing with hostile law enforcement.
Yeah, I think we'll do what the first thing will be to have people speak about their experience in the, and like Billy hopefully will come. So Billy just got arrested out of the benchlands, and what happened with Billy is that he was ordered to move his camp from one side of the drainage ditch from the, where the tap is to the other side. So he did do that. And then the police, once he got everything set up, the police came in, arrested him, took him away, and then they just took all his belongings and threw them away. And they tagged his garbage that they left after they destroyed all his stuff, and, you know, as being some violation of something. Then they let him out just a few hours ago, and he comes back to see that he's lost all his belongings. And it's just what was remaining of his camp is a big pile of garbage that now has to be thrown away. So, yes?
Isn't there an ordinance that they have to store your belongings for, I don't know, 3 days or something? Isn't there an ordinance?
They have that law, but that law has not yet been used yet. I mean, randomly it is. Every once in a while, somebody gets their stuff taken. You can go to Washington Street, and you can stand there on you one time almost got your stuff back, right, Trip? After about 12 trips there, Trip Catcher. Now, and so what was your experience of that? Yes. And do you have a question? Yeah. sadly, what happens is, like with the case of Billy, he's in jail, everything's thrown in a dump truck, and this is pretty common. I think that's the most common thing. And then what happens? Then you don't have a receipt. They claim you never had it. You know, so even though there's these laws, they don't. It's very rare that the city would follow them.
Everybody should be treated with dignity. That's why I tried to be a part of Food Up Off. Drew treats everybody with dignity.
Yeah.
You know, and everybody should be treated with dignity, whether you own a house or you don't.
Yeah, exactly. One second. Before I take another question from Randall, so what we're going to end up doing, we're going to do a couple of things. We're going to ask people who live in the Benchlands to come up here and speak. So that, and you'll get like a few minutes to talk. And the purpose of doing it from here is so that it goes out on the live feed to the world, so everybody can get an idea of what's happening. The second thing is that we're going to be working on some litigation, temporary restraining order. And one of the helpful things, if you have not already signed up on this, and many of you have, I think about almost everybody I know that lives outside that's here right now has. But some of you might not, and if you can't remember, if you fill this out, fill it out and hand it back to me. I've got, I have two of these. I need a second pen to send around. But then, so you fill it out and put it on the very bottom of the pile. And we right now have approximately 200 of these filled out already. And it gives us permission to file this temporary restraining order in your behalf. So that's part of what that's about. So then I'm going to introduce the president of the Homeless Union, Alicia Kuhl, and then I'll probably talk a little bit more while people gather, and just for a few minutes, and then we will start the speak out. We're hoping that some politicians will be here shortly to hear your point of view, people who live outside, particularly with the focus of people living in the Benchlands. So I'm going to pass this around for people. I think you have not filled this out, right? Okay.
So, I think I got a great announcement here. I'm passing out this thing called Resources for Resistance, which has a petition on the back of it, or many of it does, much of it does. There's two flyers, one of them. They're all pretty much this. This talks about suggestions about forming different networks of support in the event that the courts turn down the injunction that you install, and in the event that there is continued harassment of people. And it suggests that people might want to volunteer to do some of these tasks if they're interested, have the time, have the energy. So I'm just suggesting if you do, print the information on the back. And if you're in the Benchlands and you want to, put where your tent is. There's a kind of a code that says 1 near Water Street Courthouse side, 2 near Water Street River Street side, 3 near the footbridge. So it's a way of, in case the union wants to reach you, or in case you want to reach each other, that's a way to do it.
Okay. So anyway, Alicia, why don't you talk a little bit about the union and what's going on in the
Go, Alicia!
So my name is Alicia Kuhl. We have just gathered here this evening. It was a suggestion from the people that gathered last week that we come together and we make our voices heard about specific things that are going on. One is the fact that the city is going to close the Benchlands. Two, the shelter options that are being offered to people. We are opening the mic to talk about what your shelter experiences are, what your experiences are being homeless, maybe some of the barriers to the shelters. I know that a lady shared that due to the curfew, she lost her job, so she wasn't able to stay at a shelter. So it's really things like that. That we feel like city officials and leaders need to hear so that they can run successful shelter programs that really benefit the people that are using. helping them. And so that's mainly why we're here today. We want to open the mic so that people can speak. We kind of want to keep it short, and then we can circle back, because there's probably a lot of people that have a lot of different things to say, you know, different avenues of their experiences. And so we're going to open up the mic to talk about that. Who wants to be first?
You can actually hear the full 2 hours of this meeting by going to Commander X's website, or possibly tuning in to freakradio.net, or checking the archives of the HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, on Sunday when we play some more of it, if we do, although it's available. Commander X, Chris, made a very good rendition, I thought. And I think you'd enjoy it, too. And that's about it for this edition, though, of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. I've got to run and make sure it goes up by 6. Bye-bye.